Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You'll hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and Director of Strategic Initiatives for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, Ben Gittes, a senior policy analyst for the Bipartisan Policy Center's Economic Policy Project, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby, and Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman will join the show to discuss policies to help workers and families, as well as the latest on COVID-19 legislation and the budget process. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that House Democrats have begun refashioning President Joe Biden's $1.9 trillion pandemic relief plan with legislation aimed at helping some hard-hit industries and targeting direct aid more toward lower-income households. Several House committees began unveiling pieces of an aid package that would funnel new money to struggling restaurants and boost funding for the transportation industry while also offering help to cash-strapped union pension plans. In one of the most closely scrutinized changes, President Biden's proposed tax rebate checks would be narrowed in scope to exclude maximum payments to relatively wealthy households. That measure was contained in the biggest single piece of the package, a nearly $941 billion measure unveiled Monday by the House Ways and Means Committee. The Tax Writing Panel's draft legislation offers a much steeper decline in payment amounts to households above a certain income threshold. That's a nod to concerns of critical Democratic votes like Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. On Monday, he said he hadn't seen details of the House plan, but suggested he was looking for a, quote, hard stop to prevent households earning up to $300,000 from getting payments. Under the previous income thresholds and phase-outs, a family of four earning $250,000 would still get a combined $600. Under the new House proposal, by comparison, no families above $200,000 would get any rebate, regardless of the number of dependents. The Joint Committee on Taxation estimated an earlier version the House passed late last year, which contained the old income phase-outs, would have a cost of $464 billion. The JCT said Monday the new, more tailored rebates would be a little cheaper at $422 billion. Workers would see the minimum wage increase to $15 an hour, while schools and universities would receive nearly $170 billion in part to help struggling students under the House Education and Labor Committee's draft portion of the emergency COVID-19 aid package. The text would transition the federal minimum wage to $15 per hour by 2025, including youth workers, tipped workers, and workers with disabilities. But the Congressional Budget Office issued a cost estimate of the wage boost that could both help and hinder its chances in the Senate. The plan would increase federal deficits by $54 billion over a decade, according to CBO. The nonpartisan budget agency said the wage boost would lift about 900,000 workers out of poverty, but make another 1.4 million workers jobless, and about 27 million workers overall would get a pay boost. President Biden said last week he did not expect the wage measure to survive in the aid package because of a likely procedural challenge in the Senate under the rules of budget reconciliation. But Senate Budget Chairman Bernie Sanders said he was determined to fight to include the wage increase. The pandemic-battered restaurant industry would get $25 billion in federal aid as part of COVID-19 relief legislation drafted by the House Small Business Committee. The proposed restaurant relief makes up half of the $50 billion in aid to be allocated by the Small Business Panel as part of an overall package. President Biden's initial aid proposal didn't include any direct funding specifically targeted to restaurants. If passed, the bill would mark a victory for restaurants, which had been battling since last year for their own, quote, stabilization fund of as much as $120 billion. Up next, Ben Gittes, a senior policy analyst for BPC's Economic Policy Project, and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby will join me to discuss policies aimed at helping workers and families. We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Ben Gittes. Bob is the Concord Coalition's executive director and a regular contributor on the show. Ben is a senior policy analyst for the Bipartisan Policy Center's Economic Policy Project. Before joining BPC, he was deputy policy director on the team that helped Howard Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks, consider an independent run for president of the United States. Before that, he was director of labor market policy at the American Action Forum, where he researched and wrote about paid family leave, the opioid crisis, the minimum wage, immigration, and more. Ben was a member of the American Enterprise Institute Brookings Institution Working Group on paid family leave, where he developed a model for estimating the cost of paid leave proposals. He also worked at the American Action Forum as a policy analyst, providing research assistance to former CBO Director Doug Holtz-Aiken and conducting his own original labor market policy research. Ben's studies are regularly referenced by major media outlets. He's also written opinions for the Wall Street Journal, Washington Examiner, and The Hill, and he regularly advises members of Congress and their aides. Welcome to Facing the Future, Bob and Ben.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to have you on the program. And we are discussing today a pretty large and significant topic this day and age, policies that are aimed at helping the workforce, specifically workers and families, and referencing a paper that you wrote back in December, Ben, and we'll probably use that as a jumping off point as we go throughout our conversation. But the title of that paper was Coming Together to Support Workers and Families, a Pragmatic Agenda for the New Congress. And I'll ask just sort of a broad question on what were some of the issues or problems that you were trying to address in this paper?
Sure. So we essentially had two main objectives with this paper. First, we wanted to start providing some policies that help lawmakers begin to tackle some of the very serious issues that families and workers are facing today. And second, we wanted to also provide a starting point for lawmakers to begin working together in a bipartisan fashion in this new Congress and administration. And so for helping families, we know that this isn't going to solve our solutions aren't going to solve every single problem, but we hope this is the starting place. So we focus on three areas: financial resilience and wealth creation, work and opportunity, and children and families. And we provide a suite of policies to address the issues in those three areas.
Let's start off with a little background information. What are some of the drivers in those issues that prompted you to want to focus on those three areas?
Sure. So, starting with financial resilience, savings and emergency savings, retirement savings, this has long been an issue faced by American workers and families, and they've only been exacerbated by this crisis. Going into the crisis in 2019, the Fed reported that some one-third of adults said that they would have trouble covering a $400 emergency expense. And since the crisis, a lot of families have had to dip into their retirement accounts and take penalties. And the loss of employment and wages has really depleted a lot of individual savings and exposed what can happen when we don't have the emergency short-term savings that a lot of families need. When it comes to work and opportunity, employment has long been the key to economic independence in this country. If you just look at Census Bureau data, only 2% of full-time year-round workers are in poverty in 2019. If you look at folks who didn't work a week in 2019, the rate was over 25%. And so we looked at ways to both help workers enter the workforce, build the skills that they need to succeed in the workforce, and then also balance family needs while they're working. And lastly, looking at children and families, United States has one of the highest child poverty rates in the developed world. About 14% of children are in poverty now. And at the same time, this country faces longstanding issues in our childcare and early education systems, with many unable to access and afford childcare in order to support their children's development.
And Ben, before I bring Bob in, I do have sort of a generic question as a follow-up. Are these mostly short-term policies, long-term? You mentioned it was a starting point, so I imagine it's getting the ball rolling as opposed to coming up with perhaps permanent or long-term solutions.
Right. So these are long-term issues that we hope to create durable policy change for that have been greatly exacerbated by COVID-19 and become much bigger short-term issues. So take employment, for instance. I mean, that's clearly the most obvious example of having lost 20 million jobs in April last year. We're still have a long labor market recovery. Helping workers transition back to the labor force, giving them skills, that is an immediate issue that lawmakers are going to need to address. But it's also a longstanding issue because we've long not had the ability to provide workers alternative pathways to finding durable long-term careers.
Ben, to go now from the theoretical to the what's going on the Hill now to reality, actually these topics have been getting quite a bit of publicity and attention from politicians of both sides, which I think is a good thing. And you have competing proposals going on right now. So I wanted to get kind of a sense of how they compare with what the BPC was calling for in this paper. I mean, there's a very ambitious proposal on the Democratic side of new child credits, and Mitt Romney has proposed something conceptually similar. There are differences in the execution, but are those the sort of ideas that that you were hoping would be forthcoming?
Yeah. So the child tax credit that you referenced, Bob, has certainly been is featured in our paper and is become a center point for particularly the Democrats in the current relief negotiations. We have been working on developing a solution to the child tax credit so that we are able to provide the benefit to more low-income families. The current design of the child tax credit, because it phases in and is not fully refundable, excludes a lot of the lowest income children who would benefit most from it. And so a proposal that would expand the benefit for those children would help provide financial relief. I think what we've been working on, and I think what's important for a long-term policy, and keep in mind, what the Biden administration and what Democrats have proposed, these are just one-year solutions for the current crisis, but for durable long-term policy, there needs to be a holistic solution looking at all these tax credits that helps balance both providing financial relief with also continuing to design these credits in a way that supports and rewards work, which for the earned income tax credit, for instance, has been a pivotal piece of its long-term success and bipartisan support.
Just to sort of drop back to the theoretical for a minute, you mentioned something that I think would take a lot of people by surprise, which is that this country really does have a very high rate of childhood poverty. It seems odd. Why is that?
Well, one of the reasons is that we do not provide the same level of supports to young children and young families. We're also one of the only developed countries without paid family leave, and we struggle to provide access to affordable childcare. These issues compound in over generations as well. One of the National Academy of Sciences had a big child poverty report where they provided a series of recommendations to help lower child poverty. And one of the key findings of that report was that poverty creates poverty. So if you're a child born in poverty, you're more likely to end up in poverty. And so it's kind of a perpetual issue that this country faces, and solutions that help provide more resources to low-income families can help start to break that cycle.
One more question for me before I send it back to Chase. And this is more wearing my traditional fiscal hat, but we do a very good job on the back end of life with Medicare and Social Security. And that's done a lot to limit poverty among the elderly, which was a huge problem before those programs were created. And now we have childhood poverty that, and if some sort of, in effect, you know, universal entitlement were created at the federal level for children, that's a sort of a balancing of, you know, looking to the future, investing in the future, investing in our children, but it does have a big cost. And so did you address the question, or do you just personal opinion or institutional opinion, in implementing a large expansion like this, should it be something that has a dedicated source of revenue as we do on the elderly programs, or just raising, should we try to offset it in some way?
Well, so Bob, I certainly agree with you that the long-term fiscal issues is something that needs to be not forgotten in even in these current times. Like we're going to, right now we are going to have to continue to provide fiscal financial support.
Yeah, I'm talking post-pandemic.
Post-pandemic. Yeah, completely agree with you. And that's why, you know, on the child tax credit, for instance, we're like BPC, we're probably not going to come out as far, as big of an expansion as what we're seeing from the left and their centerpiece. But what's important is that that's why it's important that when we're looking at the key elements for helping families, we think about these targeted solutions to help start creating progress. While at the same time, that will help create room for policymakers to begin addressing our long-term fiscal issues. So I agree with you that we need to make sure that any new expansion for long-term policy is paid for, and so that we're not making our fiscal outlook even worse than it is.
Well, Bob, I thought I was going to get to sit back the rest of the interview and drink my coffee from my Concord Coalition cup, but I guess I'm back up with questions. And Ben, I want to bridge this conversation that Bob took us down on what reality is like on the Hill relative to, I guess, what we would like to see idealistically on some of these permanent or long-term plans and policies. And I'll take them based on the buckets of policies that you have in your report. And we'll just pick up with children and families, since that's been the most recent conversation. Can you lay out some of the specific policy items or recommendations you make in the paper relative to children and families? And this is where the bridge to reality comes in. Do any of them have bipartisan support that can be acted on sooner rather than later once we get through this pandemic?
Looking at our children and families proposals, there are, you know, childcare has long been an issue that has received bipartisan attention and support in beginning to address it. Solutions like Bob just mentioned, the child tax credit has been a bipartisan, an area of bipartisan focus. It, just in 2017, the Republicans were the ones who enacted the last increase in the child tax credit, doubling its maximum benefit. And so even though right now everything's kind of in flux with the current debates and where things will come out with the child tax credit in the long term, that's going to be an area where there's going to be continued bipartisan support. Similarly, the child dependent care tax credit, that's something that has potential for bipartisan support because it helps families afford child care for their children. It has been shown to increase work and help mobility. And another area that that has the potential for bipartisan support is also helping develop the childcare workforce. That's another policy solution that we have in our working families agenda. That helping establish apprenticeships and other forms of workforce training, to make sure we have high quality childcare providers, while we're at the same time helping families afford it.
Well, let's just keep going down the line. The other category is supporting work and opportunity creation, basically. And as you pointed out at the beginning of this conversation, employment is kind of a big deal right now. So a lot of what we're doing is to get employment numbers back to where they were pre-pandemic. But are there any longer term focused policies in this paper that, again, have bipartisan support that we can take action steps on as we move through this health crisis?
Well, one policy that has a long term a history of bipartisan support is the earned income tax credit. We've proposed an expansion in the credit for childless workers. So if the earned income tax credit, if you have children, you can receive a tax credit up to $3,000 or even $6,000 if you have three children. But if you're childless, your maximum benefit's only going to be about $500. And as a result, a lot of single childless adults end up not being able to benefit from this credit or receive that reward for working. And so an expansion in that, which has been proposed, you know, wasn't that long ago where President Obama and House Speaker Paul Ryan each proposed an expansion in the childless EITC. And that's an area where we see could be part of a bipartisan package. Lastly, included in our proposals for helping workers is a solution for paid family leave. Now that's historically been a Democratic issue, but in the last 5-10 years, Republicans have really been able to start thinking creatively and engaging in this issue because it, in many ways, aligns with conservative principles of helping workers remain in the workforce, helping them care for children and family at the same time. And so that's an area where we see that there's gonna be continued bipartisan engagement. And lastly, we have a focus on helping workers develop access to higher education and skills through alternative pathways. And that's another area where providing resources for workers, for young adults to be able to access higher ed and through an expanded Pell Grant, and also perhaps apply that Pell Grant to not just higher education, but short-term credential programs could also receive broad support.
And last but not least, the topic you started out with in the paper, and that is financial resilience and wealth creation. Where do we have bipartisan support there? What kind of policies are we looking at? I know we've talked sort of broadly on some of these things, but what fits within that bucket specifically?
So we've looked at the solutions for helping workers first and foremost begin to build emergency short-term savings. One of the issues that has become a barrier for accomplishing that is that employers face regulatory burdens in instituting short-term savings benefits for their workers. And so we have a proposal that would allow employers to automatically enroll their workers into short-term savings benefits, with, of course, giving workers the option to opt out if they do not wish to participate. But simply by having a direct connection to work and paychecks, we'd imagine that it would result in a number of workers being able to build their short-term funds. And there's also been a lot of bipartisan interest in helping, kind of rebuild retirement savings and security. About 4 years ago, the Bipartisan Policy Center had a task force focused on retirement security. There has long been bipartisan interest in addressing this issue. One of the solutions we included was expanding the Savers Credit, which is intended to help moderate and low-income families put more money into the retirement savings accounts by providing a tax credit to offset that. And so we would propose to, currently it's non-refundable, so it doesn't benefit the lowest income families. So we would propose to increase the refundability of that.
I'm going to put my fiscal policy hat on as well and ask a question relative to this proposal. And you mentioned a word that piqued my interest, and that was offset, just in your last explanation. We've talked a lot about new programs, new or expanded tax credits. Is there a price tag associated with the proposal you put out or any planned offsets? Or is this just we need to identify areas of investment because that's the most crucial point right now?
It's more of the latter. We've not calculated a price tag for all this. Like I said from the beginning, this is not going to be the set of policies that are going to fix every single problem that many are pointing out right now, but it is the starting point, and it's something, it's a modest place for lawmakers to begin with pragmatic, like targeted solutions to some of these very critical issues that the country's facing at this moment. And you know, beyond the crisis, like I mentioned to Bob earlier, it's going to be vital that lawmakers find the moment and identify the moment when it's time to begin addressing these fiscal long-term unsustainable issues that we're facing. And that's going to perhaps be one of the trickiest challenges that this administration could face, of deciding when's it time to shift from relief and stimulus and also investment in things like infrastructure and start tackling these long-term issues that have predated the crisis, but also have been dramatically accelerated by a $3 trillion budget deficit in 2020.
You know, a couple of years ago, the Concord Coalition did a project on a fiscally responsible economic growth agenda. And one of the topics that we looked at was workforce training. We also looked at productivity in the workforce. So I want to put what you're proposing here into the much broader macroeconomic context of why we need to invest in the workforce and improve productivity and bring more people into the labor force.
Yeah, that has been a key problem that has predated, I keep repeating myself, but here's another problem that has predated the crisis.
Labor force. And that's okay. We talk about fiscal policy. We repeat ourselves all the time.
The labor force participation rate of prime age workers, people who are 25 to 54, has been declining for a very long time. For men, it has been declining for over half a century. For women, it has been stagnant or declining since the early 2000s. This is something that is going to, if it continues to occur, is going to significantly hamper our ability to grow economically and increase our productivity. And so of a lot of the things that is important for helping address our current issues, but also our long-term fiscal sustainability, ensuring that we have strong economic growth, a key aspect of that is making sure that our workers have the support they need to enter the labor force and the skills that they need to continue to grow.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Ben Geddes, a senior policy analyst for BPC's Economic Policy Project, and Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby discuss policies aimed at helping workers and families. In the next segment, we'll hear more from Bob as well as Concord's Policy Director Tori Gorman on COVID-19 legislation, reconciliation, the budget process, and more. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Ben.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We'll be back after the break. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Bob Bixby and Tori Gorman. Bob is the Concord Coalition's Executive Director. Tori is Concord's Policy Director. Both are regular contributors on the show. Welcome back.
Thank you, Chase.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to, I guess it could be afternoon, depending on when someone's listening to this. We've got a lot to discuss in a relatively short period of time. It seems that Congress and policymakers on the Hill have been at least talking a lot. Who knows if we've actually had any legislation come through, but that's why we're here today discussing COVID-19 legislation, reconciliation, the budget process, and more. And Tori, I'm going to kick it off with you. We've talked about what reconciliation is on the show before. So is that where we're headed, or do we have a chance at anything bipartisan?
I think it's pretty obvious that reconciliation is going to be the vehicle. Now, whether it's that doesn't necessarily rule out something being bipartisan. And of course, it also you have to think about what you mean when you say bipartisan. Does that mean you are inviting Republicans into the room to help shape the policies that are in the reconciliation bill? You know, or does it just mean that Democrats write the bill, but they actually manage to grab a few Republican votes at the end of the process? So I think we're definitely headed towards reconciliation just because the calendar demands it. A lot of the income aid that we passed in the December bill expires in mid-March. So I think there's definitely a rush to get legislation done so none of that expires and lapses before they have a chance to extend it. Now, whether or not we're going to see some Republican influence, I mean, I think you can see that through Senator Joe Manchin. You know, he's trying to shape some of the provisions in there more in line with some of the thinking of his Republican colleagues. But whether or not any Republicans actually vote for the reconciliation bill, I don't know yet.
Yeah, that was really what I was thinking in terms of bipartisanship, having both parties capable of negotiating something at the table together, as opposed to someone of the opposing party who might vote for the package simply to save political face or the fact that it's a necessary package and, you know, they want to help their state or their district. So that, yes, you defined it well. And I think we probably will end up with the latter, where maybe a Republican or two votes for the package, but, you know, it doesn't seem like we're at the table anymore for both parties.
Right. Well, and it could be the point that, a lot of Republicans are speaking to the Democratic leadership through Joe Manchin, right? I mean, Joe Manchin represents the state of West Virginia, a very conservative state. So, you know, you can see a lot of conservative influences in some of the policies that he is suggesting shape the reconciliation bill.
All right. So what's the timeline now if we're going through reconciliation?
Sure. Right now, actually, for the next 2 weeks, the House is not holding any votes whatsoever, because they're working so hard on putting together the committees that received reconciliation instructions in the budget resolution are working so hard in putting their products out and marking them up in committee so that they're ready to go to rules and, you know, stitch it up into one big package and vote on it on the floor so that it can get over to the Senate before the beginning of March. I mean, the idea is to get this reconciliation bill out of the House by the end of February and over to the Senate beginning of March. We've already seen some committees start marking up. I know, for example, Ways and Means is going to mark up their product this week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. The Transportation Committee's already got one of their products out. So yeah, the House is already moving.
How different could the final package look from what President Biden had in mind with his $1.9 trillion package?
Yeah, I think, you know, given that this is a very new Biden presidency, I think that Democrats in the House and the Senate have every interest in trying to make this package hew as closely to his proposal as possible. I think the only thing that's going to stand in their way are certain restrictions that exist in the Senate pertaining to a reconciliation bill. We've talked about the Byrd rule and stuff like that before. But we've also talked about creative drafting and how that can be used to get around a lot of those. And I think we're seeing that, especially when it pertains to discretionary appropriations. So I think that to the extent that Joe Manchin agrees with what Joe Biden wants to put in his COVID bill, I think Biden will get what he's asking for. But again, at the end of the day, Democrats need 51 votes to get this bill across the line. A tie doesn't win. So they need Joe Manchin in their corner, and they need to listen carefully to what he says in terms of what I'd like to see and what I need to see.
One question that just came to mind, and I'm not asking for you to render a judgment on what's going to be a Byrd rule determination, what's going to get, quote, birded, I think is how you've described it in the past. Mm-hmm. But it seems like some of the policies that might end up in the reconciliation bill are trending toward being too creatively written and perhaps might get birded. I don't know if you agree with that and if you see some areas where that might be the case.
Well, I think the big news this week is that the Congressional Budget Office put out their analysis of the minimum wage increase. Bernie Sanders has proposed increasing the minimum wage from $7.25 to $15 in a series of six increments between now and the year 2025. And CBO took a look at that proposal and they scored it as the overall number was $54 billion. And I know that a lot of Democrats are thinking that, aha, that's clearly budgetary. That's compliant with Byrd. And I think they may be surprised to learn in the end that it probably, I believe that it is still in violation of Byrd rule proposals, just because a lot of those budgetary effects are secondary in nature. They're not, you know, first order effects. And I just don't think that they'll pass muster with the Senate parliamentarian when it comes to the Byrd rule.
And I want to circle back to a topic that kind of discusses the partisan fault lines. But before we do, I want to go to Bob, a concept that, or a rule of thumb we've always discussed when it comes to emergency relief is the three T's: targeted, timely, and temporary, when it comes to some of these policies. And being the executive director of the Concord Coalition, I'm just curious where you see this package headed. Is it largely abiding by those guide rails, or are we drifting afield a bit and trending towards things that are wholly unrelated to the emergency and underlying emergency?
I think it's drifting a bit and morphing a bit with the budget to come. Remember that what we're talking about now is an emergency supplement, you might say, to the CARES Act and the bill that was passed in December, the whole idea being responding to the healthcare emergency and the economic fallout from that. So there are natural components like extending the enhanced unemployment benefits, aid for acquisition, distribution, administration of vaccines that are directly related, whether it's small business loans or targeted relief for the airline industry, things like that. Things that are clearly targeted to those most affected by the pandemic. But, you know, there are certainly proposals in there. Tory mentioned the minimum wage increase. There's a major new proposal coming out of the Ways and Means Committee for a enhanced child tax credit. And it's not meant to be temporary. It's meant to be a permanent new program that just happens to expire after a year. You know, in that one, it doesn't even kick in until July because the IRS is supposed to administer it. It's kind of complicated in how it would kick in. And part of that may be because of the reconciliation process. So there's one that doesn't even go into effect. It's a major new initiative that doesn't go in. It's like over $100 billion, 120 or something like that. Doesn't even go into effect until July. Targeted, timely. I mean, I'm not, and it might be a perfectly good idea. Don't get me wrong, but I think it ought to be considered in the context of the overall Biden budget. This is just step one, the emergency response that we're looking at now. He's going to have a much bigger proposal sometime in the next few weeks that's based on his whole Build Back Better campaign proposals that are going to have much, much bigger numbers, cover a much, much bigger range of topics. And some of these things ought to be left for that broader debate rather than just continuing the response to the pandemic.
Sort of a philosophical follow-up question, Bob. You mentioned the increasing size price tag of these packages moving to Biden's first budget. Is it possible policymakers or the public might have some price tag fatigue, or is it just we're going to push through what we can and you know, bar none when it comes to cost?
Right now, there doesn't seem to be a lot of fatigue, but sometimes at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, you think you're going strong, and all of a sudden, you're not. Here's the thing that I think the Democrats are going to have to decide how much deficits matter to them, I guess, because a lot is going into this, and you saw a widely circulated op-ed by Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, this week, kind of warning. He didn't say he was opposed to the Biden proposal at all. He just said, look, fellow Democrats, there are limits. You're going to do a huge amount, nearly $2 trillion bill on top of $900 billion that was already passed in December. Most of it is transfer payments. Most of it is not the sort of big economic investments that we all want to do. And we may run into these limitations. putting so much stimulus into the pipeline that we're not doing the kind of investments that we really ought to be doing. If we're going to do this massive deficit spending, we ought to be doing it. We ought to be saving that for the Build Back Better agenda and not having such an enormous, rescue relief plan. So I think that it could happen. I think that's a very cogent warning, because I think if you get, you get $900 billion in December, you get, almost $2 trillion in March, and then almost immediately the administration comes along and says, and now here's like $9 trillion and offset by $4 trillion in tax increases. And you could get people saying, oh, my God, I can't process all this. So there is some danger that everything goes into this bill and then it's difficult. But let me, before I end on that, I think that's why it's very, very, very important for working groups. Like you mentioned Manchin, he's worked with Susan Collins as a group of 16 senators that said they're going to work together on a bipartisan basis. I think if I were to give some advice to them or a plea, it would be think about that big Build Back Better agenda and try to think about some, the best way to do that in a bipartisan basis. It may be too late to do that on the COVID relief bill. You might be able to get a few things here and there. But I really think it would be a huge, huge mistake to go into the enormity of the Biden budget to come and to try to shove that through on a party line vote.
All right. Well, going from the bipartisan back to the partisan with Tory.
I do the big picture.
Exactly. There you go. It's the kumbaya.
Back
bring
to
everyone
the nasty
together.
Nasty nitty gritty.
So we're running short on time here. So probably not too thorough of an explanation. But Tory, where are some of the biggest partisan fault lines in this relief package that's coming through? And do they set themselves up to push us back into this, partisan stronghold, put your heels in the dirt and try and get your way approach to the budget process beyond this?
So let's talk first about sort of the major sort of partisan split divisions on this bill. First and foremost are the recovery rebates. I think Republicans have been clear that they'd like to target this next round of recovery rebates. Definitely those individuals and families and households who are more needy. There's some disagreement over the extension of the unemployment insurance, the length, but also the Democrat proposal to actually increase the weekly pandemic unemployment insurance benefit from $300 to $400. Obviously the inclusion of the minimum wage increase, and some non-coronavirus related spending. And then when you stir that all up into a pot, the biggest thing is cost, right? The Republicans put forward a proposal that was one third the size practically of what Biden is proposing. So that's sort of where the partisan fault lines lie on the bill in a big picture sense. What does this mean going forward in terms of partisanship? After 4 years of President Trump, the Congress has become very transactional, I think. Just because this is moving forward on a very partisan basis, I think there might be some hurt feelings for a little while, but there are some agenda items coming down the pike that I think Republicans and Democrats are very excited about working on together. Bob was talking about Biden's Build Back Better an initiative. There's infrastructure is something that always brings Republicans and Democrats together. So while we may be stepping on some toes now, I don't expect this to be permanent ill will.
This is Facing the Future. You've been listening to Tory Gorman and Bob Bixby discuss COVID-19 legislation, reconciliation, the budget process, and more. Thanks for joining the show, Bob and Tory.
Thank you.
Thanks, Chase.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.